If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive series available only on Patreon where we take a close look at a different Texas murderer each episode. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around until the end of the episode for a promo of our friend's podcast, Pretend Radio. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thought that our friend had done it, that he was in love with this girl, and Carla's brother had a few dates with her, and that had done this in retaliation to Carla's brother going out with, you know, his girlfriend.
The list of individuals who were questioned, scrutinized, or peered at under a raised brow during the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office and Fort Worth Police Department's investigation into the abduction and murder of Carla Walker seemed endless. Some were taken more seriously than others, of course. An orderly at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth made remarks to a nurse there that he had knowledge of Carla's homicide. The nurse was vehement that the police look at this man, because every time the orderly approached and spoke to her, he was always wearing a surgical mask, which made the woman feel extremely uneasy. When Tarrant County learned of the man's comments, investigators Jim Minter and Bobby Wessler placed him in custody for questioning. Minter has referred to him as a weirdo. At the station, they took his prints and compared them to the partial palm prints taken from the Ruger clip found on the scene of Carla's abduction. The man was cleared eventually, though the sheriff's office knew the prints might not belong to the perpetrator. But it was among the scant amount of evidence that they had that would allow them to detain a suspect. This was one of just hundreds of persons of interest that the sheriff's office themselves investigated. If we'd have zeroed in on the right guy, Jim Minter told us, he would have confessed. Another confirmation that the police meant business while searching for Carla's killer, both Fort Worth police and the sheriff's office, and they weren't afraid to knock some heads, right or wrong. Many of the Fort Worth police and sheriff's office investigations began with optimism that they'd found their guy, but ended with dead ends. It wasn't for a lack of trying, we're told. Upon researching similar homicides around the time of Carla's abduction and murder, we came across a few that were particularly interesting. Since many rodeo and carnival workers who'd been wrapping up events just before Carla's homicide were scrutinized, coming across a man named Roy Lee Shoemaker immediately caught our interest. On June 2, 1975, a minister from Denton, Texas, was visiting the Chickasaw National Park, then called Platte National Park, in Sulphur, Oklahoma, with a group of young men from his church. The men were hiking a trail when another man, appearing to be in a great hurry, sped past the group, causing them to step from the path quickly. They continued their hike. Making their way several yards down the path, one of the young men noticed something unnatural to their surroundings about 50 feet off the path. The young man was startled and presumably shocked, so the minister took it upon himself to investigate. When he got close, the actuality of the scene was, perhaps, more gruesome than is imaginable. The body of a young woman laid in tall brush, nude except for her bra and shirt, which had been pushed up to her neck. Her legs were spread. Blood ran from her mouth and covered her face. A stick had been gouged down her throat and was protruding out. The young woman was Marina Rose Howeth, a 17-year-old originally from Concord, California, who had moved in with her aunt in Sulphur about 18 months prior. Roy Lee Shoemaker was identified and confessed days later, as the police had the forethought to investigate the carnival workers, who had arrived only the day before Marina was brutally slain. Shoemaker resided in Duncanville, Texas, during Marina's homicide. Duncanville is located just southwest of Dallas, and about 30 miles southeast of Fort Worth. Information that can put him in Fort Worth in February of 1974, particularly the 16th through the 20th, has proved to be elusive. But the point of introducing Shoemaker wasn't as much to say he should be looked at for Carla's murder, as it was to give an example from the seemingly endless list of madmen from the Dallas-Fort Worth area that stalked the two cities during the time. Since we began researching Carla's case, we've been privy to many theories and rumors surrounding the urban folklore that looms over the case like a storm cloud that never bursts. Some of these have existed since the day Carla was taken and contain grains of fact and truth. Others have only recently come out and tend to change or grow around facts that contradict them, only to eventually become these behemoth-like conspiracy theories that would chew up and spit out the most convoluted Kennedy assassination theories. However, we did find a couple that we were able to substantiate with at least some facts and witness corroboration. It is not known if those described were ever on the police radar, so at this point their identities will not be disclosed. The first man that grabbed our attention was a friend of Steve Walker, one of Carla's older brothers.
I called to let you know that I was having a conversation the other day completely unrelated to the Carla Walker murder. This other person and I were talking about a mutual friend of ours, and she happened to say, oh, he had a theory about the Carla Walker murder. She said, well, he always thought that our friend, acquaintance, had done it, that he was in love with this girl and was head over heels about her. And Carla's brother had a few dates with her while he was in love with her, and that he had done this in retaliation to Carla's brother going out with, you know, his girlfriend. And he, 5-ish months after the Carla Walker incident, committed suicide. And this friend of ours thought it was in remorse over what he had done with Carla. This individual was tall, skinny, sometimes wore cowboy boots, sometimes wore a cowboy vest. Kind of fit the description of everything. He was into drugs, and not just marijuana. He was into the heavy drugs. Kind of a want-to-be thug, extremely rich parents who got him out of trouble all the time. Now you're mad at Steve for dating your girlfriend, and so you grab his sister. And then, like you had said, you know, what he gets such publicity and gets going, and now you've got this girl, and what the heck do you do? How can Daddy get me out of this one? She knows who I am, and her brother definitely is going to recognize me. Her brother's going to really come kick my ass. All these years later, just to hear this, I didn't want to be the one that sat on the information. I have forwarded a picture that was taken down on the beach in Galveston. Thought it might be helpful if anybody out there could recognize this person as being around the bowling alley, or even maybe identifying the vehicle that they're sitting on.
The woman mentioned in the narrative that you just heard was his wife of almost 5 years, and they were in the midst of a divorce at the time of Carla's murder. We have been told that he was in love with her to the point of obsession. He was described to us by multiple sources as dangerous, a thug, and potentially capable of executing a crime such as the murder committed against Carla. His father, apparently, used his social standing and affluence continuously to keep his son out of jail. This man was in and out of mental health facilities, and was involved in a shootout with police in southwest Fort Worth when they came to raid his home for drugs. He and his wife were arrested for heroin possession after the raid as well. He worked for the Texas Highway Department and was found with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the chest at his home in a Fort Worth suburb. It was ruled a suicide by the medical examiner and was just 4 months after Carla's murder. A former Western Hills alum told us another story that we couldn't dismiss. On January 27th, 2017, the local NBC news station aired a cold case segment on Carla Walker. It wasn't until then that many who were familiar with the case had heard the mention of morphine in Carla's system. Hearing this triggered a memory for one former Western Hills High School football player, which prompted him to call and report his memories to the Fort Worth Cold Case Department. This individual contacted us as well after we began releasing the podcasts of Carla's case. He said he wasn't sure if the information was pertinent to the investigation, but some details he'd recently heard about the case and how they matched some of his own recollections of certain individuals and events shouldn't be left unknown. This gentleman has always been straightforward, honest, and his story has remained consistent. It is important to remember that morphine was found in Carla's urine and blood, and this wasn't necessarily a popular street drug by any means.
He was a friend of a friend that we used to go and buy drugs from. Had access to prescription pads that he'd stolen from his dad, who was a doctor. And he would write prescriptions and go and change into prescriptions to drugs, and then he would sell us the drugs. He would also offer us prescriptions if we wanted them, to where we could just go pick up our own drugs, but we never really did that because he always had plenty of stuff on hand. He was just really a very, very strange character. He didn't fit in at school at all. I knew him some at school, and he was just an outcast. We had a group of, we were kind of separated by the athletes and the socialites, and then there was what we called the dopers, and he was one of the dopers. He was just really, really heavily involved in drugs. And the times that I did go over there and spend time at his house was mostly in the evenings. And whenever I would go to his house, more than once, he showed me cats that he had strangled that were the neighbor's cats. And it was just out of the blue. It wasn't anything that we asked to see. He would just take us out into the edge of the yard and say, this is one of the cats that I strangled that belonged to my neighbor. And I know that he showed me at least two different times where he'd strangled cats. And then later on, as we continued to go back, he started to offer to inject us with morphine that he said that he had stolen from the emergency room at a hospital that his dad worked at. Stepfather, wasn't his father, it was his stepfather. He had access to that and syringes, and he said, man, it's just the best high ever. Don't you want to try this? And I never would because I don't like needles of any kind, but I did see the morphine. I don't remember reading the label on the bottles, but I remember him showing it to us and saying, here it is, and this is what it is, and things like that.
It was confirmed by multiple sources that this Western Hills student also possessed a human fetus in what looked like a pickle jar, and that he would shake the jar at his guests and remark that this was his aborted brother in an attempt to shock them. We were also able to talk to a woman who'd been a girlfriend of this individual in 1973 and early 1974. She provided us with additional details and insight.
Well, I understand that you have some questions about a guy I dated in high school. His father was Dr. So I met his mother a few times. I couldn't begin to tell you what her name was. Yeah, he had a car. I think it was a Pontiac, maybe a Grand Prix. It was gold colored. We hung out. We went to the bowling alley. We went to the lake a lot. We were out at the lake most Friday nights at Betty's Hole. We went to the drive-in, Cowtown, out Highway 80. We went to the Dairy Queen. We hung out there quite a bit. We went to Taco Bell. We didn't hang out there much. You know, we'd go there, get something to eat. We hung out a lot at a place called Cougar Country. It was a place just right a couple of blocks down from the school. I think it's on the corner of Bangor and Williams. Anyway, they had like foosball tables and stuff, and so a lot of kids hung out there. Yeah, they had music, and they had foosball tables and a couple of pinball tables. You know, we hung out there a lot. Yeah, he had some pretty crude sense of humor. I think maybe the thing that I finally really broke up with him over was that, you know, he was rather crass and crude. I mean, he was kind of weird. The last time I saw, oh, Lord, I don't know, maybe about 77. He had left town and came back. He OD'd on something right after I broke up with him. and his mother blamed it on me. It would have been 74, springtime.
A friend of the individual's girlfriend remembered his overdose as well.
I remember him ODing. I remember he got sent away. And then it seems like when he came back, they got him a house on Clayton Road.
Through these conversations, we learned of a friend of the dope-dealing teenager, one who dated the interviewee we just heard from.
One of the things that I do remember about is that he had a bad family life. I think he had a good home family life, but he didn't get along with his family. And they kicked him out on a consistent basis. And I remember him staying at Lake Benbrook several of the times that he was kicked out of his own house. And I remember that story well because we would go to the lake for different parties. We used to have what were called beer busts, where somebody would buy 3 or 4 or 5 kegs of beer, and they'd go out there and they'd charge $2 a head, and everybody would sit around and drink beer. And I would see him there, and he would tell me, I used to camp right over there across the river or right over here, and I've camped here before. And I said, oh, you camp a lot? And he said, well, no, I've been kicked out of my house a lot of times. I'd come out here and stay.
Well, he didn't go to school with us. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure it was. He went to Southwest. Yeah, because he wasn't one of the Benbrook bunch. He lived in Wedgwood. He finished school and joined the Marine Corps.
He was nice at first, and then got very demanding, and I kind of blew him off then. I know he went into the service and got incarcerated for stealing a gun or something in Oklahoma City because he used to try to get me to come see him. I've always had weird feelings about him, but so he was a little creepy there. I mean, when you think about it.
These friends are perhaps worth exploring further, considering their geographic and social proximity to Carla Walker. Both of these individuals went on to spend time in the Texas prison system, and one of them would go on to accrue a lengthy rap sheet that included possession of morphine, aggravated assault on a police officer, manufacturing and distributing of methamphetamines, larceny, and finally, 2 counts of aggravated sexual assault against a young woman who was staying with the man and his family. The young woman stumbled upon pictures of herself nude in the shower. When she confronted the man, he grabbed her from behind, threatened to break her neck, handcuffed her, and used a stun gun to stop her from struggling. She was then sexually assaulted. During this brutal assault, the woman claimed that this man showed her a video of her laying nude on a bed in an unknown room, blindfolded. The young woman said she had no recollection of this ever taking place. When the attack was over, the man pointed a gun at her, threatened her life if she told, and subsequently allowed a family member to drop her off at another location. A police search of the man's home uncovered the evidence used in the attack, including many pictures and videos. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, we'll share some closing thoughts on Carla's case and hear from her best friend, Connie. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Gone Cold Podcast with a friend, or you can stop by our Patreon page and make a small donation. We'd like to thank former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter, Robbie Patton, Beth Patton, and Gail for their contributions to this episode. And of course, we'd like to extend a huge thank you to the Walker family. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or virtually anywhere else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Twitter or Facebook by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we post pictures about the case and discuss all things Texas true crime and beyond. If you enjoy true crime, we'd like to suggest checking out thetruecrimefiles.com. The cases presented there are always immensely interesting, well-written, and thorough. There you'll also find book and podcast reviews. Also, if Texas true crime is your thing, Be sure to check out CowtownCrime.com for many interesting stories that have occurred in the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Thanks for listening, y'all.
At the heart of every crime, there's a lie.
In order to do this job well, you're going to have to learn to lie. But you're going to have to remember who you're lying to and when to lie and when not to lie.
But a lie is only powerful if you choose to believe it.
It all came out. All the story came out. It turned out he had 2 wives and 5 fiancés, that he wasn't marrying women because he loved them. He was actively impregnating women to rip them off for money, me being one of them.
So why do we fall for it every time?
My father told me at a young age, he says, Carl, the 2 easiest things to sell anybody, anything that'll improve their looks and anything that'll make them money. And that's what you want to sell.
Pretend Radio is a documentary podcast about people pretending to be someone else. I interview real con artists, snake oil salesmen, and former cult members. Anyone living a lie. Search for Pretend Radio wherever you get your podcasts.